We're studying from the testimony of St. John, chapter 20, which, as we will see, is probably the last chapter of the text. Chapter 21 shows every evidence of having been added later for particular reasons. That doesn't make it irrelevant or illegitimate, but it probably is not a part of the original account as we have been following it from the beginning, where we encountered the divine Logos coming into mortality, becoming Jesus, the Christ, and then following through his ministry, and specifically his Gnostic ministry, which is what John focuses on, up to his crucifixion, and now we come to the resurrection. Our text starts by saying that it's the first day of the week. Now this is important because the first day of the week is also the eighth day of the week. That is, if we follow through the 7 days of the week, we get to the next day, which the next one after seven is eight, and we're back to the first day of the week. And this was not lost on those who wrote the scriptures. This is significant because if we take the number eight and we turn it on its side, we have the symbol for infinity. And then if we take one end of it and just slice it off, what we have left is the symbol for a fish. Now, the fish is a symbol for Christ, and specifically for Christ as he, that is, for the Christ consciousness, Christ coming out of the unconscious, because the unconscious is water, often symbolically, in our dreams, in meditation. When we see a large body of water, is probably the unconscious. And the fish coming, swimming up out of the depths is the Christ consciousness coming out of the unconscious into consciousness. So we have all these different symbols because we are being introduced here to an archetypal situation. And as we go through this chapter, we're going to find this whole resurrection testimony is all relevant to us in terms of archetypes. So we're dealing here with the eighth day of the week. We're dealing here with resurrection to divine life, which is infinite life, therefore the symbol of infinity. And we're dealing with the Christ archetype swimming up out of unconsciousness like a fish. And all of these things are implied to us before we even start out by saying that it's the first day of the week, which is all the eighth, so the eighth day. Anyone who knows any numerology will recognize the significance of the eighth day, and the writer of this gospel, we know from several different things that he says, is aware of numerology and assumes that we are. That is, not to numerology in terms of fortune telling, but to numerology in terms of realizing that certain numbers have significance in terms of our mental functions. And they specifically have certain unconscious implications in terms of drawing realities out of that unconscious to consciousness. Having established ourselves in an archetypal world right at the beginning, the first sentence goes on to say, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb. Now again, this is important in terms of telling us where we're at, because Mary Magdalene is Sophia. She is the feminine manifestation of the Christ on the mortal plane, just as Sophia is the feminine manifestation of the archetypal Christ. The crucifixion has occurred now. It's separated Christ and Sophia, separated Jesus and Mary on the mortal plane, just as in our Gnostic myths we read about Christ and Sophia being separated on a cosmic plane before this world came into existence. In each case, is talking about differentiation and how in the differentiation process we get splintered. And our existence is the quest for wholeness. Resurrection is going to bring us the key to that wholeness. So we start out here by the emphasis being on Mary. Now, in some of the other Gospels, the emphasis is on one another of the male disciples, but the other Gospels are mostly not written specifically for Gnostics. And therefore, this deeper understanding may not be there at various points. But John, the author of John, knows exactly who he's writing for and exactly what he's saying when he has Mary be the one to come to the tomb. The tomb is cave. It is the unconscious. And it's Mary who's come to it looking for her contrasexual self, her other half, which is buried in the unconscious, buried in the cave. This occurs, our text says, early in the morning while it was still dark. Now, as we'll see, the son of propriety, and we're using the term S-U-N here, the son of propriety, which is Christ, has risen. But the sun in the sky has not. It's still dark. It's very possible this is intended to tell us that we're in a dream state. It's still dark. We're still asleep. But the sun of propriety has risen in our dream state, which is able to tap into unconsciousness. We are dealing here with the unconscious rather than the conscious world. Because all of these events that are transpiring have their significance when they transpire in us. When Christ rises in us, when the Son of Righteousness, the Son of Propriety, rises in us and sheds its light in our souls so that we become enlightened, transformed, and resurrected ourselves. The stone has been rolled away from the entrance to the tomb. In other words, the unconscious has been opened. The tomb is the unconscious, the cave. Water is the unconscious, a cave is the unconscious. It's covered by a stone that seals it off from consciousness. But now, that's been rolled away. Because of the power generated through the crucifixion, the unconscious is opened. Now, that doesn't mean that all its contents come spilling out. Just like so far, we have a tomb and it's open, but there's no Christ been encountered yet. But it makes the possibility there. The power of the crucifixion has opened the door to the unconscious so that we can encounter its contents, including the archetypal Christ. Now, the entrance to the tomb is also the entrance into new life, divine life, above the mortal condition. Because death and birth are the same event looked at from opposite sides. And that is always true. Wherever you encounter birth or death, you also encounter the other. When we are born into this life, we die somewhere else. When we die from this life, we are born somewhere else. We move from one plane to another. Moving off a plane is death. Moving on to a plane is birth. And they always happen at the same instant. They are the same experience. So the tomb has been opened, and resurrection, which is birth, is able to happen because death has happened. Death, now if we take this into ourselves, death is the death of the ego, which through individuation is resurrected as part of a resurrected psyche. So it's that death of the ego that makes resurrection into an individuated psyche, a whole psyche, a sanctified soul possible. It's through death to life that we always go. Two angel messengers are sitting on the stone that had blocked the tomb. And this is what Mary sees. In other words, it had blocked the entry to the unconscious, it's been moved aside, and there are two angel messengers sitting on it. Now, these angels are also archetypal figures. And it says specifically in our text, not just that they're angels, but angel messengers. Now, the two terms are often used interchangeably because an angel is pretty much always a messenger. But when it says angel messenger specifically, the emphasis is on the message. That is, they're not just sitting there. They're sitting there to deliver a message, to announce the emergence of the Christ archetype to lead us to wholeness. And where are they sitting? On the stone that blocked the empty tomb. On the stone that blocks the unconscious. They're sitting there to draw our attention to it and deliver to us a message. We, in this case, being in the account, in the person of Mary. Mary is there seeking wholeness. We come to the tomb seeking wholeness, seeking the Christ who can make us whole. The angels are sitting there to tell us something that will help. But if they don't speak, it's because they are not yet given the opportunity to speak. They have to be invited to speak. If an angel comes to us and we just look at it, it won't say anything. We have to ask it, we have to invite it to speak. We have to invite it to deliver its message. So far, the angels are just sitting there silently in front of Mary. So far, we've been on sentence one. And this sentence starts with the words, seeing that all these things happen. Because it's Mary's perception of all these things that's important. It's Mary seeing what we have been describing that's important here. Some people would stand there and see a tomb. Some people would stand there and see an empty tomb. But Mary saw angel messengers and an open tomb. An invitation to enter and explore the unconscious divine reality that the Christ brings into consciousness. It's Mary's perception that's the important thing here, and she's perceiving the possibility of getting deeper into divine reality and finding the Christ nature that she's lost, that's been buried. Mary, however, did not go into the tomb. She did not go into the unconscious. She ran. She ran to find Simon Peter and the other disciple whom Jesus loved. Peter, in these accounts, is always the egocentric psyche. He wrestles with the Christ. He's trying to come to the perceptions of the reality. He's struggling to break through. He's the ego going on his trip, as each of us does as we go along until we finally break through. The other disciple, whom Jesus loved, is the individuating psyche. Jesus loved him because he was becoming individuated. We can't assume he was at this point. The implication is that he was not. But he is getting there. He is seeing. He is moving into that reality. They both come running to the tomb. They both come to the unconscious to see what Mary has discovered. John, the individuated, or almost individuated, the individuating psyche, arrives first. And of course, the individuating psyche is going to arrive first at the unconscious, at the reality of the greater, at the revelation of the greater reality that is in the unconscious. It arrives first, it sees the empty tomb, it recognizes the reality of resurrection, of individuation. But its enlightened nature, it being John, it being the individuating psyche, its enlightened nature includes what we call a bodhisattva nature. Now, the concept of bodhisattva comes out of Buddhism, but it's a valid concept, and since we don't have any other term, that's the term we'll use. It's the concept that a person who is at the door of enlightenment, the person who is crossing over into the threshold of divine life, if he is truly filled with love, is going to have the desire to help others make that transition. And therefore, instead of just plunging forward and severing ties to the mortal condition, he's going to remain in the mortal condition, not remaining in mortal himself. So Prajna says he's going to remain in the mortal condition. He's going to become divine. He's going to remain on the mortal plane to help others come to that divine reality which he has found. John has come up to the empty tomb. He has seen the reality of resurrection. He knows what that means for him, but he stands at the door for Peter to catch up. He knows already, without going into the tomb, he knows Peter needs to go in and have this experience, and he's going to see to it that Peter makes it before moving in himself. That is revelatory of the nature of priesthood. The concept of priesthood is that we don't hold to ourselves the gift we have received of divine authority, of increasing perception of reality, but that we try to have others come to the same revelations, to the same, the place where they can receive the same gifts. And that's what John was exemplifying by waiting for Peter to come. It's the meaning of Christ's statement when he says that you remain on the mortal plane, but you are not of the mortal plane. When we are sanctified, our substance is not of the mortal plane. This is no longer our home. We become, as the author of the homily to the Hebrews said, strangers and foreigners here, wandering on this mortal plane, never finding a place that's really home for us, because our home is beyond this mortal plane. But we're here for a reason. He uses Abraham as an example, and Abraham gathered souls to him and helped them to find the same sanctifying power he had found. That's why we remain here, even though by nature we should be somewhere else. This explains why Christ subsequently says to his disciples who have accepted the reality of his resurrection, as we're going to find if we were to jump to verse 21, I am sending you to minister just as my father and mother sent me. The ordinances you perform, I will validate. When you declare that the effects of the illusion of separateness have been reversed in someone, they will be reversed. When you declare someone sanctified, that person will be sanctified. But when you declare that a person remains under the illusion of separateness, that person has not yet been enlightened sufficiently for the effects of that illusion to be reversed. So, this can't be said to just everybody. It can't even be said to all the priesthood, but it can be said to those who have been individuated, those who are sanctified, because they are in a position to help others transcend, and through using their priesthood in the ways it's talked about, to help them become freed from the illusion of separateness and so forth. Finally, John and Peter, and Mary, I presume, who was behind them, grasped the fact that Jesus had been resurrected. For until then, they had not really believed the scriptures which said that he would rise from among those who had died. That is, they didn't understand what it was about. They were just looking for a physical resurrection, and that didn't make sense to their mortal minds, so they weren't able to really grasp it. Not suggesting that there was no physical resurrection. In fact, John seems to say quite clearly there was, but that's not the essence of it. And it takes on meaning when we see it in terms of our own development, because then it has a place in us. And it becomes the power for our transformation, our resurrection. Then it begins to make sense. And everything the scriptures say about it begins to fall into place. And we see that the scriptures are a guidebook to resurrection, to achieving psychological wholeness. And that's what the whole account has been about. All that we've done from the beginning of John till now has been to help us gain keys to see how we can come to and continue to increase in psychological wholeness. Well, then Peter and the other disciple returned home. They found what they were looking for up to that point, at least. They found enough to work with, and they went home. But Mary Magdalene remained outside the tomb weeping. She still hadn't caught the vision of it, even though she was the first one to begin on this vision quest. As she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb again. She's still seeking. When she did, she saw two angels wearing white clothes sitting where Jesus' body had lain, one at the head and the other at the feet. Those angels haven't given up on her. And this time, one of them says to her, Madam, why are you crying? He's not delivering his message because she hasn't asked yet, but he's giving her the chance. And she says, and that's an indication that Mary's moved forward from the first encounter with the two angels on the stone. She's come to the point where they perceive that if she's got just a little prod, she will open up to their message. this, someone has taken away the body of my Lord, and I don't know where it's been placed. So she gasped this. She's still crying. She's seen the evidence of the resurrection, but she's still trapped in the illusion of separateness. Resurrection has not yet become a reality for her. She's centered in the fact that Christ is gone, not that he's resurrected. Turning around, Mary saw Jesus standing beside her, but she didn't recognize him. Now, we know from other Gnostic texts that this was a common experience even during his lifetime, and that tells us that even in dealing with Jesus' mortal ministry, we are dealing with him as an archetypal figure, because he appeared differently to different people. Children often saw him as a child. Old people often saw him as an old person. People saw him as what they could relate to. Well, Mary's seeing him as a gardener, because that's what she expects to see in a garden. She doesn't see him for who he is yet. He says to her, "Madam, why are you crying? Who are you looking for?" He's prodding her on to see what's going on. She still thinks he's the gardener. So she says, "Sir, if you've taken his body somewhere, tell me where you've put it and I will take it away." Jesus spoke her name, Mary. When he called her, she was flooded with the realization of who he was. Now, he'd said her name many times, and she recognized him saying her name. And that opened her vision to the whole thing. She cried, "Rabboni," which means "my master" or "my husband." Now, this term Rabboni was also used in reference to deity. So, it's an affirmation that Christ was her divine other half. Her master, her husband, her God. All of these things are summed up in this term Rabboni. And that means that he could make her whole. He was the part of her soul that was missing. Now Mary is seeing what resurrection is all about. She's encountered the risen Lord, and she finds that he is she, or that he is what is missing in her if she is to become whole. Now resurrection has taken on its real meaning for Mary. She threw her arms around him. Now, people, we get the picture that she's holding on to him so he can't go away, which is a little bit true, but not in a physical sense. What she wants is to become one. We want to become one with someone, we get as close to them as we can. In fact, our spirits extend out around us for some distance, which is why if you get into an elevator, everybody stays very quiet and looks ahead. It's not really comfortable, because we're meshing with other people that we don't have any relationship with. Our spirits are intermingling, and there's no basis for it, and it's not totally comfortable. When we talk to people, we stand back a little. The closer we are to them, that is, the closer we feel to them, the closer we can comfortably stand to them. If we truly are united to people, then we get as close as we can, and that goes all the way up, of course, to sexual intercourse, where you try to bring your bodies together just as your spirits are together. Mary's holding on to Jesus because she wants to be one with him. She recognizes he's her missing part. But he says, "Don't try to hold me here, Mary, for I must ascend to our divine parents to dwell among the Elohim, where you will join me later." We can't bring the divine down to live on the mortal level. We have to ascend to live with the divine on a divine level. Jesus is saying, "Mary, you don't try to hold me down here, but you rise up. Be with me on the mortal plane, because I have to ascend to the divine. And so do you, if we're going to be whole." When Jesus had left her, Mary hastened to tell the other disciples that she had seen the Lord and what he had told her. What do we do after we experience transcendence? We witness. We tell others of our experience so that they may have the same experience, so that they will open up to the same possibility. Witness is an essential part of resurrection. St. Matthew says that after his resurrection, Jesus said to his disciples, "Go everywhere, telling everyone what you have experienced in the resurrected Christ." Telling them assume that they need to be immersed and come forward to have this same experience. If we encounter the resurrected Christ, then we must witness to others that we have encountered the resurrected Christ and what it means. Because all they know is the Orthodox Easter story. They don't know about the archetypal Christ who can change their whole lives and their very nature and bring them to resurrection, to live divine life even while they're on the mortal plane, and to be part of that ministry. We need to share that witness of what we have experienced. Again, our scripture tells us these things happened on the first day of the week. And we're going to go through a couple more resurrection accounts, and they're always on the first day of the week, which means on the eighth day, which brings into play all these archetypal symbols that we started out talking about. At sundown, the disciples met together. They had the doors locked, fearing that the rulers might be searching for them now that they had finished with Jesus himself. Now, rulers is a translation of the Greek term from which we derive the word archons. They were afraid that the archons were after them now that they had apparently put the archetypal Christ in his place, knocked him out of consciousness. And they were afraid because of that. So they had locked the doors. Now these doors are psychological doors, obviously, because they're being locked against psychological forces, which is what the archons are. But their doors locked by fear, which means that they will be totally ineffective in keeping the archons out. Fear invites the archons in. You can't put up a door of fear and keep any psychological forces out. The good news is they're just as ineffective in keeping the Christ out. Fear can't keep out archetypal figures any more than it can keep out any other psychological forces. So, as our text says, suddenly Jesus was standing among them. Peace be with you, he said. This is the peace that surpasses mortal understanding. He's not talking about peace from persecution, and he's talking about a psychological peace, an internal peace, an inner peace that nothing outside us can touch. It has its source in the divine, specifically in divine wholeness, which becomes possible through the encounter with the archetypal resurrected Christ. So he says, peace be with you, because peace is a possibility once now that they are encountering the resurrected Christ. Again, Jesus said, peace be with you. He said it twice. It's got to be important. We're not finished with it yet, but we're going to move on for a minute. One of the 12 apostles, Thomas, who is called the twin, was not with the assembled disciples when Jesus came. When Thomas returned, the other disciples excitedly told him, "We have seen the Lord." Thomas retorted, "Unless I myself see him, feel the nail holes in his hands, and touch the wound in his side, I will not believe these stories about his being alive again." Thomas suffers from bad press. He's not put in this account to be the doubting Thomas, as he's called in our culture, popularly. Rather, he's an example of the Gnostic seeker, because the Gnostic knows that he can experience for himself, that he can experience the resurrected Lord, that that's his right, and that until he does experience him, he will not have any real transforming power in him. So the Gnostic goes out to experience the Christ for himself. When he hears the testimony of others who have experienced him, he says, good, but I'm going to experience this for myself, because that's the only time it's really going to have any impact on me. Now, we can believe in the experience of others, but we have to know for ourselves, through our own experience. That's what Thomas sets before us. He's an archetypal figure too. One who wholeheartedly embraces reality when he experiences it. Embraces Gnosis when he experiences it. Now, Thomas has always been highly regarded in Gnostic circles, unlike Orthodox circles. The sayings of Jesus are attributed to Thomas, the apostle. And Gnostics speak well of him. Among Gnostics, he's never the doubting Thomas. He's always the archetypal Gnostic, the one who shows us the way to the Christ, which is through our own experience. 8 days later, the disciples were again meeting on the first day of the week, and Thomas was with them. While they were praying, Jesus appeared among them once more, although the doors were all shut and locked. "Peace be with you," he said. That's the third time he said this. It's important. Resurrection is all about peace. As long as we're subject to the mortal condition, we live in turmoil. St. Paul talks about that, for one. It's just a tumultuous existence, and it is. But only when we transcend the mortal condition can we live in divine peace. In other words, when we're resurrected, we live in peace. So each time Jesus says, "Peace be with you," he's saying, get the reality of this resurrection in you so that you can live in peace instead of in this turmoil, this fear, this unreality of mortal existence. Peace needs to be with you. Peace will be with you when you experience resurrection. And it increases in you the closer you come to that experience. Then he said to Thomas, "Come touch the wounds in my hands and my side. Do not doubt what you are experiencing, but believe that it is I who am here with you." Thomas replied simply, "My Lord and my God." This is Thomas' affirmation. Thomas was not doubting. Once he experienced the risen Christ for himself, he instantly believed. He didn't have to come and touch him. He knew because he experienced him at that point. Thomas was not really willing to know without that experience. Now, we experience the reality of the risen Christ too. And when we do, we know for ourselves, just like Thomas did. He's showing us our need to experience reality. That's what it means to be a Gnostic. Then Jesus said, "Thomas, you are blessed because having seen me yourself, you believe that I am here," said Jesus. "Still more blessed are those who believe that I am alive, although they have not yet seen me." The focus here is that it's not seeing. It's not a physical event that's important. It's experiencing Christ in our inner reality. That's important. Then we know. So he was in essence saying what Thomas already knew, in essence, that it wasn't the seeing that made it real, but the encountering. The experience of the reality of the Christ that made it real. For John, this is it. Having established this, the resurrection of Christ and his ministering in each soul to bring us to wholeness, he's ready to conclude. He says, Jesus gave his disciples many other evidences that he really was resurrected, but they cannot all be recorded in this testimony. He's left it open for many other Gnostic testimonies of the resurrected Christ we have, because most Gnostic texts deal with the Christ after his resurrection. That's the focus of Gnostics. These are recorded, that is, the ones John has recorded, so that you will believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the Elohim. For if you believe that, you will learn how to receive life through the power of his name. Now that's the summation of Gnosis right there. And for John, that's the end of the whole matter. Probably, as I've said, this was the end of the text originally. Chapter 21 appears to be an addendum added later to meet certain situations that had arisen, and it seemed a good place to put some other things that perhaps had been experienced with the resurrected Christ and seemed to fit in with John's testimony, probably too short to make a book of their own. All of which is valid and legitimate in Gnostic terms, but we're probably looking at a separate text when we come to chapter 21, which will be next time.